JTA says it wants to expand the Skyway with new riderless cars. More controversy inside JEA, this time over racist emails. And drama and intrigue among the local GOP. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and our WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Then later, we speak with former A Prairie Home Companion host, Garrison Keeler. He'll be in town this weekend. We'll tell you about it. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday. Time to look at the top stories of the week as we welcome Sebastian Kitchen of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
A.G. Gankarski with Florida Politics.
Hello.
And our own WJCT reporter, Ryan Bank.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to have you. Lots to talk about. From problems inside JEA, Jacksonville being named a top tourist destination, and more news. We'll get into it and get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937 to join the media roundtable. Here's our top story of the week, though. JTA, the Jacksonville Transportation Authority, is proposing major changes to the Skyway. Now, what they want to do, potentially, is replace the Skyway rail system with driverless vehicles. They would go on the existing Skyway routes, but also run from Riverside to the downtown sports complex and Everbank Field. What do you think about that? We're already getting your tweets. Give us a call. Not surprising. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. Sebastian Kitchen of the Florida Times Union covered this meeting of the JTA. What exactly are they looking at? Riderless cars.
Right. And the current Skyway is a riderless vehicle also, but it's also 27 years old. And so that there needs to be a change if they're going to do anything different. So I think about a year ago, the board indicated they wanted to expand the Skyway and they wanted to maintain it to keep it. And what staff discovered is they're 27-year-old vehicles. They're expanding it would be and maintaining it would be continue to be very, very expensive. The parts are obsolete. It's a really expensive system to maintain. So they went out, they looked, and they thought their best option would be these new emerging autonomous vehicles that could operate on the path that Skyway currently uses, but then also get down onto street level and operate in traffic. But there's still a number of questions, a number of issues that they have to work out, which would include the costs, the time frame for moving forward, and some major issues. So we don't know at this point what the price tag might be for this.
Right. Driverless cars on the Skyway, as Sebastian pointed out, they already are driverless cars. But let us know what you think about this new look for the Skyway at 549-2937. Tim Gibbons, the Skyway has been something of a white elephant for decades in Jacksonville. I think there's a fair amount of skepticism as to whether JTA can really do anything good with
right.
it.
Right. As well as being driverless cars, they're also riderless cars right now. And that's a yeah,
that's a problem.
That's a challenge. Jacksonville is not a public transportation city. And the Skyway has been a white elephant, a credible attempt to do that when it was planned. But the system that was actually built doesn't really go anywhere. It doesn't really serve anything. It is great during things like the Jazz Fest. But as far as actually moving people around, it just doesn't work. So if JTA is going to do something, it has to expand it, and that's kind of a hard push politically.
That's always been tough because people complain that it doesn't go to the places they want to go. A.G. Gankarski.
Yeah, and you got to look back at when the Skyway was designed and planned in the late 70s, the Godbold administration. By the time it was actually rolled out, downtown had basically died as a retail destination. Regency was booming then, Orange Park Mall was booming then, and so on. And you know that gets to the paradox of centralized planning on things like this. When you have a city that is decentralized, that is predicated on growth models that see people always moving out to the suburbs. Yulee's hot. St. John's County is hot right now. Downtown, they're trying to make happen. But, you know, you're going to ask yourself when you're looking at these programs, especially on a federal level with funding, you know, what's the real ROI? You know, what, you know, actual usage can be anticipated? What actual usage can be driven? Because, you know, the people in Jacksonville show a preference for cars over automated transportation.
And that's why all of downtown development, though, is really a big puzzle that you have to piece together. So you get something like the Shipyards project. If that takes place, if you have, you know, stuff happening in the urban core, then the Skyway makes more sense. But the Skyway functioning just on its own isn't necessarily a big enough piece of the puzzle to...
You need a comprehensive transit system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they did talk about how they thought that would be helpful for the development of downtown, so people can move between entertainment or work or lunch, or eventually if the district brings more people and other residential developments bring more people, then it gives a way for people to get around within downtown.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of like one of those things where it feels like kind of the best laid plans. It's a broken promise almost. It's like you see this, you can see when you go on the Skyway, you can see like what they had in mind, and it's a great idea. But if you walk around downtown, to everyone else's point on the panel, there's just doesn't seem like there's a whole lot around here to do. And aside from that, most people live even farther out than Five Points or San Marco or these other places that are closer to the urban core. So I just don't see how you can justify the expenditure on something like this.
Let's go to your calls as we talk about the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. What do you think of JTA's new proposal for the Skyway? Autonomous vehicles or driverless cars going from Riverside to the sports complex? 549-2937. Do you think this will happen? What do you think? Let's begin with Jimmy in Riverside. Hi, Jimmy. Good morning.
Hey, there, Melissa. Thanks a lot for taking my call, guys.
Sure.
I just heard talk about the potential comprehensive plan or what you guys would like to see as a comprehensive plan. I totally agree. I love the notion of it being expanded, but I think my concern is, are these riderless autonomous vehicles going to be able to get to ground level, make it all the way to the beaches, make it to the town center, make it to UNF, JU, even Mayport and NAS Jacksonville? I feel like there's plenty of people that live in those areas who would love to be downtown. And if we have these riderless vehicles, I feel like they'd go too slow, first and foremost. And B, I'd imagine you'd need to have a driver on most LRT systems, at least, once they get to sort of ground level. So I'm a little concerned and curious about, if we're not planning properly now about where this thing can go in 15, 20 years, are we going to pigeonhole ourselves into only having this downtown circulator?
Yes.
Thanks, Jimmy. Tim.
There's the thing. The idea of having a bunch of vehicles that move people around downtown is great, except there's not a lot of people moving around downtown. So there's a little bit of a mismatch of supply and demand for this. Anybody who talks about public transit basically wants that beaches to downtown, wants UNF to downtown sort of thing. But that's a lot of money. And quite honestly, America likes to put that money in transportation projects, into building more lanes on highways, not into public transit.
At a certain point, though, when is that going to see diminishing returns? Because the whole concept of new urbanism is doing the opposite of that, pushing people back into the city center, not sprawling them out.
And new urbanism is a great idea that Jacksonville hasn't particularly embraced.
Yeah, and if you look what JTA is doing, one of their most exciting projects is the Green Line, the First Coast Flyer, which basically, express coming from, the hinterlands toward the central city, dedicated lanes and so on. And, they've got $57 million committed to that. And, that seems like a better use of resources in many ways, because if you have people who are living outside of town coming into town, you're trying to drive that, then it follows that you want to speed up that happening. Downtown traffic is not a burden compared to a lot of places.
We're getting lots of tweets about this,
so,
by the way. Yeah.
This is really something where you look at it and it's like, well, what should JTA really be doing? And, I'd say amping up the First Coast Flyer project.
And by the way, the CEO of JTA, Nat Ford, has appeared on this program. He appeared the last few weeks. Then they are ramping up the First Coast Flyer, actually. He joined the show to talk a little bit about that. They opened a new leg of it, yeah.
The blue line.
Now, here are a few tweets about the Skyway. Michael says, expand it. Self-driving cars are perfect for future taxi and Uber drivers. Good for the environment and the city. Here's another tweet. Stick with the Skyway. Update it. Make more connections. Expand it further out. JTA is tweeting the show to point out, this is from JTA's Twitter account, the Skyway averages 5,000 trips a day and provided 1.18 million trips this past year.
Well, those are statistics and those are great, but when you look at the Skyway, you don't see people disembarking from the Skyway. Like, it's, you go to a DC metro, you get in New York City, see the subway, you see jam-packed stations, you never see that at the Skyway.
It's not even comparable to Miami's metro rail. Of course, it's a denser city, but even then, it's not a New York or a Chicago, and there's still massive traffic going through the monorail there.
And well, part of that is due to the fact that, you know, those cities were built on grids in the during the Industrial Revolution. You have massive urban density in those cities. This city was built in the era of the automobile, and it was built to, as you said, Tim, to accommodate a car culture. So much of this is cultural, getting people into a different mindset, getting people to think about living in an urban, more denser neighborhood. A lot of people don't want to do that, and until you can convince more people to do that, public transit's always going to have a hard time in a city like
this. Which is the interesting thing on those tweets. You do have people who clearly love the Skyway and use it and think it's great. But you also have the big push is go from the beaches to downtown, which isn't a density thing. It's, you know, people who like the idea of public transit. And are there enough of those to justify putting millions into a, you know, a line going to the beaches sort of thing?
That's what I'm saying. If we had a really dense yeah. neighborhoods, well, many of them all concentrated around the urban core, you would be able to get the return. You would be able to make it feasible.
Well, that's
so,
why.
But Jacksonville is far from that, and so I think you can't. In a community that one, Duval County is so large, and then when you incorporate St. John's and Nassau, you know, the hinterlands, as AG likes to affectionately refer to them as, it's such a large spread out community. But as far as the caller earlier was talking about expanding it out into some of these other lands, and in the discussion at the JTA meeting yesterday, that was not part of the discussion. They want to get it into downtown and into adjacent neighborhoods, Brooklyn, Riverside, San Marco, and be able to do that and have a circulator within those, because they did talk about Miami and how that does create a circulator where you can kind of move around. Whereas if you've ever been on the Skyway, it goes to a point and it turns around and comes back. It's only 2.5 miles of track, so they're fairly limited in what they can do with that.
But if you look at an area like King Street, where, you know, that actually is in some ways that part of Riverside kind of is going in a new urbanism sort of direction, a mass transit system taking people there and not having people park their cars on people's lawns actually is a logical sort of idea.
How do you work out right away on that? You've got property values that are blown up over there.
Oh, right. I mean, and, massively too expensive. But I mean, the idea of if you're looking for a place that's logical to go, going through Riverside, San Marco sort of connector does make sense. I don't know how you make the math work, though, on, as you're talking about, land acquisition costs.
Jessica's downtown. Hi, Jessica. Good morning.
Good morning. Listen, I really appreciate you guys addressing this topic on your show. I think it's very timely. I'm a mother of two young children under five. We live downtown and we work downtown. I love the Skyrail for its potential. However, the one thing that I haven't heard anybody discuss is how can you guys enforce security? There's a big homeless element that seems attracted to the stations and the cars themselves, and it's honestly why I don't use the system more.
You worry that it's not safe?
Yes.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jessica.
People tend to be mentally ill.
Okay.
And make public disturbances.
All right. Thanks for the call. That's not a concern I've heard a lot of, but what about her concern?
That's a real concern. You know, it's if you go to Hemming Park after 3 o'clock on any given weekday, it's like Hieronymus Bosch, Garden of Earthly Delights. I mean, you see people fighting, you see people cussing, you see all these things happen.
I think this element
gets on the Skyway, too. I mean, you have a population in the city that is dispossessed, and, you know, many of them...
That's every city. I got to jump in here. I've lived in large cities. When you take public transportation, you know that there will be homeless people or mentally ill people sometimes on public transportation.
How do you sell a capital outlay to people who are living in the suburbs?
Like I said, this gets back to mindset and culture.
You can't
reset
people's mindset.
We don't have the mindset and the culture in this city where people just assume that is part of the deal.
That should be the starting point of the discussion. I mean, we can't change people's mindsets with
infrastructure. I think this is a perfect example of how you can't just have a discussion about transportation without having a discussion about development, without having a discussion about how we treat our homeless population, how we treat our mentally ill. All of these things are connected. The problems with downtown are many, and you know, the Skyway suffers from those problems. That's really what we're dealing with.
Some of these vehicles they're doing these pilot programs in other places, such as in Maryland with the Ollie vehicle that I referenced in a Money story. They do have the ability to communicate where there's somebody constantly monitoring them, where they do have the ability to communicate. So I think, if nothing else, there's nobody on them now. As far as a driver or security, but you would have some access to. But I don't know that completely eliminates the caller's concerns. But I would imagine JTA is aware of this, and they've increased security at some of their spots, and so this would be something that they would discuss as they move forward with
this. There's also two different issues, and this gets back to the mindset thing. One is true security. You're on a car and something bad happens. Okay, how do you prevent that? The other is the feeling of insecurity. You're on the car and there's a homeless person there. Nothing actually bad happens, but if you feel uncomfortable, you're not going to ride again.
Right.
So that second bit, that's a lot harder to deal with because JTA can't stop homeless people from riding the Skyway.
Ben tweets the show, worst case scenario, there's just as much ridership as there is now. Best case scenario, it would revolutionize Jacksonville public transit. Let's go to a few more of your calls. David on the south side. Hi, David. Good morning.
Good morning. Excuse me. I have a problem with all this discussion because what's happened is the flyers or the route, like to the avenues and other places, came at the expense of the routes in the neighborhoods. What we need to spend money on is a bus route that's predictable, faster. We talk about spending money to go to the outlying cities to bring people in. So they bring them in, they come into town, and it takes 2 hours to get across town to go where they're going. They aren't going to come. We don't spend the money in the right places because if we look, it tends from my view that JTA in this investment might have a federal grant that drives money for some private company that goes in, and once it done, they'll make the money. We'll end up as citizens to support it. We've done it early before the technology is settled. I mean, if we're going to spend money, if you increase the bus routes, people get decent jobs because they can get there faster and get home faster. This has to do with what you were talking about. You have to talk about the homeless, the economy, where the money is, where the jobs are. We don't have a discussion. The discussion that we have in the mornings is a very thin group of people who come on the radio, and many of...
I don't know how thin I am, but I appreciate you saying that, David.
When I say thin, I'm talking about the demographics of the city.
I see.
Really not a representative.
Not representative.
Community.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And that's why we open the phone lines up to the whole city. And I appreciate that call,
right,
David.
But there doesn't seem to be much discussion about the economic help of the whole city and the maybe fundraisers on the west side, the east side, the north side, the south side. There seems to be a limited corporate special group that's, and I'm not saying it's not needed, but we just need a community. A community is a group of people, not solely a physical entity. What makes us a community is the people.
Thanks, David. What about his comments?
I mean, to his point, that I think that's the whole point of rapid bus transit here is to connect people with faster bus routes to different areas of the city. When the project is all done, when it's all said and done, almost every portion of the city, just about every portion of the city, is going to be layered with these flyer routes. And you know,
you would hope would address some of his concerns about more reliable and quicker transit for people that need to get to better paying jobs that might not be in their part of town.
Right. Public transit has always been seen as an economic development thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the first route that JTA had going from downtown to the airport was actually paid for by a Department of Labor grant, not Department of Transportation, but it was a way of getting workers from basically the central bus station out to the airport area to work out the, you know, or that River Place, whatever it is, out there. So, I mean, it clearly is an economic development.
And 80% of the flyer money comes from the federal government. So, and I think the total number on that was close to $30 million. So,
by the way, speaking of data from JTA, we're getting a lot of tweets from JTA right now. As you guys continue this discussion, JTA tweets the show again. JTA has security, including JSO officers at all our Skyway stations, and the trains are monitored. Skyway vehicles have intercoms on board, and JSO officers are available for immediate dispatch.
Well, that's great, you know. But the perception is that once you get off the Skyway, you're on your own. If you get off the Skyway in Hemming Park, you're on your own. And, you know, that's the thing. It's not hermetically sealed. This
I know, but the caller, the woman that called said she was concerned about being on the unit without security. I think JTA is just letting us know there is security.
It goes back to your point, Melissa, though, of that mindset cultural change sort of thing of if JTA can say as much as they want that they have security and the Skyway is safe, and I'm sure you could pull up crime statistics and they're not as bad as people would expect. But you know, crime in downtown isn't as bad as people you know, think of it as, but
Springfield's a different matter.
It is a.
Well, they would dispute that,
don't dispute it. I know somebody's had like multiple break-ins over the course of a year, and it hadn't happened before.
But what I'm saying is that people in Springfield will be quick to point out to you that there's property crime at the same rate at lots of neighborhoods around the city. That there's a perception that they have a bigger problem with it.
Yes, the stakeholders, the talking points, people of Springfield will tell you about it. The people who actually live there and deal with it, the urban pioneer types, will tell you a different thing. You're still going to see the crackhead with the shopping cart going down the street at all hours, and you know that's an issue.
Do you walk around Hemming Park and most of the downtown adjacent areas with personal security? The AG's description of some of these neighborhoods is a little
around,
bit different than what I've seen.
I walk around ready to go. I walk around. If somebody wants to throw down, they're going to throw down with me.
Interesting.
Because I know who I'm dealing with. I have lived here for a long time.
Where is this coming from? Like, I've never heard you talk like this before about Hemming Park and Springfield.
I've written many columns about Hemming Park and the dysfunction there, and it's like the Springfield thing I wrote about in Jacksonville Bold like this week. I mean, these things are happening, and you know, we can pretend that you know everything is fine and great in these neighborhoods, but it's not. There are issues with security, and you know, it's because you have an understaffed sheriff's office. It's because you have resource issues in the mental health side. It's because you have a homeless population that's not being dealt with, and all these things converge to make it dangerous for property owners. I mean, I don't know how you can dispute that.
Then what are the solutions? Because we can have a more in-depth conversation about what needs to be done to address all of these interlocking things. And it always comes back to the same thing, doesn't it?
We don't
have enough money to pay for the initiatives and the additional police officers.
Or we just won't.
Or there isn't the political will to address these issues in a meaningful way.
I'm curious on the downtown issue. We had a discussion with the mayor this week at the Jacksonville Business Journal discussing downtown issues, and he said that it was basically behind public safety his second priority dealing with downtown. And we were talking about mainly in an investment standpoint, but if you're going to fix downtown, dealing with the homeless problem, dealing with all of the other interlocking things downtown is a necessity. It's interesting if downtown truly is a city priority, how those things play out in terms of you know putting officers downtown, investing in things to make people both be safer and feel safer.
Yeah, and I think you know we have to take a look at what their approaches are to solving these problems. Because if you look at the Hemming Park issue, what they're discussing now is, you know, how can we make it easier for police officers to trespass people? How can we make it easier for them to kick people out of Hemming Park? And these people don't have anywhere else to go. If you move them out of Hemming Park, they're going to go somewhere else.
That you actually would be in favor of, you know, basically police cleansing Hemming Park. That doesn't seem to be the type of thing that your politics would lead you to.
Well, you've got public safety issues in Hemming Park. You've got people who are basically dispossessed and no access to social services. You got a bunch of dudes with green polo shirts saying, okay, I can give you social services and that's it. I mean, there's not recourse for people, you know, in Hemming Park. And this is why the city is running into issues with the Friends Project. They put $1 million into Friends of Hemming Park, and it's gone to basically nothing. And that's because, you know, they haven't solved the basic problem, which is the front door of City Hall, wherever they want to call it, you know, basically has a bunch of people sitting there at all hours doing nothing and contributing nothing.
But if you looked at the Friends funding, there were a lot more issues than that.
Yeah, I've looked at it. I've studied those meetings. I've sat in there. But it comes down to public safety. You know, it comes down to basically Sam Moosa being able to look from the fourth floor of the mayor's office and seeing people drink out of brown bags at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right next to the kid zone. You know, and, you know, if you think that's a good thing, if you think that's sustainable, then, you know, we've got, you know, a different set of priorities.
So maybe we also haven't talked about the fact that they closed the drop-in day center for homeless people.
Yeah, that was 2 years ago.
Yeah, I know. And look where we are.
Yeah, I mean, but and yeah, there were still the issues 2 years ago, too.
But you know what? We need to talk
about the issues 20 years from now.
We need to move on. Let's move on and talk about a few of the other items from the week. Also making headlines this week, JEA is launching an internal investigation into inappropriate emails circulated by employees. Now, the email surfaced at the same time the federal government is looking into Jacksonville's public utility for alleged racial discrimination in its hiring practices. Ryan Bank, our own WJCT reporter, broke the story of the EEOC investigation at JEA this week. Employees also shared with you inappropriate emails. JEA is now investigating this, saying that these emails violate company policy.
Right, and we talked about it yesterday, and the story came out as well a day or so ago. But basically, what we had was when we first reported on the EEOC complaints, five employees came forward saying that they were they had filed complaints with the EEOC and received formal charges. We talked a little bit yesterday about the process. You file a complaint, you send a letter essentially to the EEOC. The EEOC looks over your letter, figures out whether it has enough merit to give you official charging documents. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are saying that discrimination actually happened, but it does mean that they are looking into whether a further investigation is required. This process takes years in some cases. Every one of those employees who filed the complaints received the official charging letters back from the EEOC. And upon the release of the original story, we had someone come to us and bring us some printed copies of emails they said were circulated in JEA. None of the emails had people's actual email addresses on them. So I had to basically make a public records request with JEA to figure out whether or not these were authentic, and they ended up being authentic. They were sharing a couple of different racist images and frankly very racist jokes. Now JEA says that, you know, they're absolutely very concerned and disgusted by it. I talked to Angie Hires, who's the chief human resources officer, and she basically says that they're conducting an investigation and they'll see how these emails got past their filters and whether or not the employees that are still employed there that forwarded this material need some type of disciplinary action.
And the emails are ancillary to the main story, which is that there's an active EEOC investigation into hiring and promotion protocols at the utility. And as we've discussed on this show, not just within JEA, Tim Gibbons, proving bias, proving that there was intentional bias is a high bar to prove. So we'll have to follow this story. But the five employees at JEA have been collecting documentation and they anticipate other employees might join their complaint.
That's what's interesting about these emails and the great reporting on getting all of this. I was listening, Melissa, to your show yesterday, and you had a caller who basically seemed to be making the point that, well, these are from, you know, years ago. They don't really matter anymore. And I think that why these emails are such an interesting, important thing is it's really hard to prove bias a lot of times. And yes, this goes back. But if somebody sent this email in 2007 and now is being accused of less blatant racism now, yeah, you can look at a pattern there. Quite frankly, that line about the filters, I'm kind of interested in what the filter has caught.
It's supposed to catch specific search terms. So,
right, but I'm just wondering, like, if you looked at some of these employees, you know.
So if you just sent, I think as you described yesterday, is something that's essentially what we call now a meme. And so it's not
and
in the subject
or in the
words.
And these were racist memes. Right. They were images. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I described them yesterday.
They had memes in 2007.
They're very, I would put it like almost like prehistoric memes. Yeah. You know, they're kind of like pre-meme. I described them yesterday. It's kind of disgusting to talk about, but they, you know, an image showing several black men running away from a black child with holding a sign that says "Daddy," and then the subject line is "Father's Day in the Hood," and you know, it plays on all these really, really old stereotypes. And again, I want to just clarify too that it's only two email chains. I mean, and I've only been able to verify that five of those employees who shared them are still at JEA. So, you know, this by no means proves some systemic issue at JEA. However, it is the employees who file their complaints. It is their opinion that this sort of bolsters their case, along with the demographic information about JEA, that there is some type of cultural issue.
And I was curious, and you may have just addressed it, Ryan, but if you've heard or seen any more evidence of more emails, or obviously there's systemic issues that have to deal with the hiring and the reported, or alleged systemic issues with hiring and promotion issues, but that if you've heard or seen any more as far as emails or correspondence that would be troubling, because I did see those images and they're incredibly racist and they're incredibly troubling.
Yeah, and you know, we've had calls of other employees since the release that, again, they say they're employees. I haven't yet been able to verify everything and say that they have more information and more emails of the same type of material. I'm working to try to verify that, but I also want to say that the complaints that are being filed are individual complaints, so they're not necessarily alleging, even in each one of their individual complaints, that there's a systemic issue. They're basically saying, here's my story, and I was passed up because I'm African American for a promotion. Just want to clarify that.
Okay.
So it's not.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. The number to join us, 549-2937. This is a disturbing story. Duval County high school students are reporting higher than average rates of suicide attempts. This is awful to read. Superintendent Nicolay Vitti addressed the report Tuesday at the school board meeting. He said the district is going to push for more mental health funding and try to expand services to kids. In last year's anonymous youth risk behavior survey, nearly a third of Duval high schoolers said they felt sad or hopeless almost every day. One in five said they'd considered suicide. 20% said they'd made a plan to commit suicide. That is a terrible report to read and very upsetting. And of course, going back to the question of funding, we are not a lavishly funded mental health region. So as the Duval County School Board tries to address this with more services or funding for children, the dollars, they simply aren't there.
Florida's what, 49th in the country?
Right.
You know, this reflects a lot of other issues. I mean, you got single-parent homes, you got homes where the grandparents raising people, you've got economic dysfunction, you got disparity. And, you know, this is why the kids are feeling this way. I mean, if kids don't feel safe, if kids don't feel protected, if kids don't feel loved, then, you know, these kind of depression issues, these kind of other mental issues start cropping up in their teen years.
And even Absolutely. In some completely healthy, happy homes, sometimes the mental illness is a real thing. And so I think even if you grow up in a Brady Bunch family, in a Cleaver home, you know, Beaver Cleaver home, there are sometimes, you know, children that are just, you know, that have these issues. And so they need to be addressed.
Northwest Jax.
And so, you know, to look, you know, so the superintendent talked about funding and hoping to find funding. But I think as we've been talking about with some of these previous issues, it's easy to talk about funding. It's hard to find it, especially hard to find it in a level that'd be sufficient. But, you know, Melissa was just talking about those stats. But roughly 19% of Duval respondents said they'd actually attempted suicide. That's more than twice the national average.
Yeah.
So even among that demographic, that's an incredibly high and incredibly troubling number.
It's very troubling. Now, this week here in our building at WJCT, all of the players around the field of mental health had a big meeting where they talked about progress in this area of trying to raise more awareness about these problems, systemic problems all across the community, trying to raise awareness about the need for increased funding. Obviously, Superintendent Vitti is going to join that push. But whether we're talking about transit, whether we're talking about teens' mental health, all of these issues, I think, reflect some of your comments, reflecting almost an anger and a despair, A.G. Gankarski, about the state of things in this community and a lot of these issues that are interlocking.
Well, I mean, I think anger and despair is kind of a strong statement, but, you know, the fact is that, you know, what you've seen over the course of decades is a redistribution of wealth where the top 1%, you know, benefits. You've seen the middle class decimated in the last decade. You know, even the Obama recovery, that money went to, you know, the millionaire and the billionaire set. So what we've seen is, you know, a gradual neglect of the social safety net, and this is where we are, you know, on issue after issue. It's the elephant in the room.
Well,
I agree. Even everyone that gathered for that JCCI task force unveiling of this report, even they were well aware of the bleak nature of the future going forward. They got modest reform that they were very, very happy about. Standardization of mental health courts, pilot program in Duval County, money that they found for to start raising money for a central receiving facility, which will help connect people to social services. So to what we were talking about earlier about Heming Park, instead of these people being arrested, they're going to be taken to a central receiving facility and connected with services. However, this is just the foundation of a very, very modest reform to the system that needs to happen. And with the state budget expected to be very thin this next year, you know, with uncertainty about the healthcare system as a whole nationally, these advocates are not really optimistic about how much they'll be able to build on that progress moving forward.
And maybe we can get a little money from tourism so we don't end on a complete tale of woe this Friday. I'm going to throw in one positive story at least.
Love those segues.
TripAdvisor has named Jacksonville as a top city.
Just don't go to Hemming Plaza.
A top city that more people are choosing to visit.
Go ahead.
The travel planning and booking site released the names of cities that made the traveler's choice for destinations on the rise list. Jacksonville's number 10, followed as we go up the list by Columbus, Ohio, Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Dolly Parton lives there, of course. Tucson, Arizona, Houston, Texas, Colorado Springs, Louisville, Portland, Maine, Park City, Utah, and Kihei, oh, Hawaii. So kudos to Jacksonville's Visit Jacksonville for spreading the word about us as a tourism destination.
The Skyway is the main reason people come to visit, right?
Tax Slayer Bowl.
Yeah, well, there's also our beaches. There's also our climate. I mean, there are some good things here.
Right. As I see on social media, all of my friends who live north of here who've had on their thick, thick coats, which apparently Melissa did earlier, listen from earlier, it's their in their coats and toboggans and gloves. I'm pretty happy that I've put my jacket on for the first time this year. So the climate is pretty tough to beat.
All right. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. When you talk about crime and fears of crime, at least in Florida, we are the only state where people break into a neighbor's home just to pet the cat. Yes, WFTS in Tampa reports that Brittany Klein of St. Petersburg was grateful she wasn't hurt when someone broke into her home at 3:30 in the morning just to hang out with the pet cat. She was in a dead sleep when her cat jumped off the bed and woke her up. She saw the man standing at the end of the bed. He was simply crouched at the foot of the bed, petting the little kitty cat. From there, Klein said he disappeared into the night. It turns out he was her neighbor. Jasper Fiorenza is now charged with burglary.
Maybe that's all the stuff you're talking about in Springfield. It's just, you know.
Just want to pet the cats.
And only in Florida does a marathon runner get lost in the woods. Melissa Kitcher is in good spirits, though, after she was found Sunday night after getting lost during a half marathon trail run. Over in Sarasota, she wandered around the 25,000-acre park for nearly 12 hours. Her cell phone froze before the race, but she said she never worried. She knew her family would eventually find her. She plans to run the Sarasota Half Marathon in March and finish without getting lost.
Life goals.
Thanks to our panel, Sebastian Kitchen, Timothy Gibbons, A.G. Gankarski, and Ryan Bank. We'll be back with more in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
When you're experiencing the in-depth content of WJCT, you know there's always something more to explore, regardless of the device. It's a special commitment sharing the world, and as such, WJCT is an indispensable service here on the First Coast. Truth is, however, that such content, whether you access it via television, radio, or various digital platforms, is expensive. Costs that are largely funded by people like you. So please, during this season of giving, stand up now for your cherished values of curiosity and excellence with your vital year-end investment. Your support makes it possible for WJCT to continue to share your community, your world. Do so today at WJCT.org. Thank you.
Welcome back. Well, for decades, he was the host of the popular A Prairie Home Companion. Even though public radio icon Garrison Keillor retired from that show earlier this year, he is staying busy. Keillor appears Sunday at the Florida Theater. I spoke with him about his career and some of his current political observations. Take a listen. Garrison Keillor, a pleasure. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
It's exciting that you're coming back to Jacksonville Sunday night. And, of course, this is sort of a bittersweet moment for all of your fans because it is the final season of A Prairie Home Companion that we air on Saturday nights here at 89.9. As you think about the end of this incredible program, will you talk about that on stage?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. What will I do on stage? I always collect my thoughts by standing out on stage and singing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, God Bless America, America the Beautiful. And then if they feel like it, we go on and sing a few more. And while we're singing, I think of what I'm going to do, or, you know, the route that I will take.
So you just come up with it as you go along when you do a one-man show?
No, it's the beauty of doing a working solo that you can make abrupt turns, and you can leap. You don't need to be afraid of non sequiturs. You just plunge ahead. My head is full of stuff, and I wouldn't know how to write it down and organize it. So I just launch.
You just plunge in. But you've been writing a lot lately, and in particular, Garrison Keillor, you've been writing a lot about Donald Trump.
I have, because, you know, he's there, and he's not like anything anybody had seen before on the national scene. And so, I mean, you have to, you know, it's just inescapable.
You've written some very eye-catching columns noting the division in the country in the wake of his election. You wrote a column before Trump was elected theorizing that you thought he was running for president in part just to get the respect of people in Manhattan that he had never been able to get. Where'd you get that sense?
It's an odd fact that he keeps complaining and complaining and complaining about the New York Times, Saturday Night Live, and CNN. And you would think he would just stop reading the paper, for heaven's sake. I mean, it's been a fairly liberal, democratic paper on the editorial page for as long as I can remember. But there he is at 56th and Fifth Avenue, mm-hmm. right in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, surrounded by people who voted probably about 85% against him, and he wants respect from New York. He grew up in Queens, and Queens looked across the East River to Manhattan and yearned for success over there. He built a big building there, but he's been abused and scorned by the New Yorker, the New York Times, you know, all of the big heavyweights in Manhattan, and he wishes it were otherwise. I don't talk about politics on the stage. I'm very clear about that. I tell stories about my family, about my mother. I love radio comedy. I tell stories about my ancestors who came over from Yorkshire. I talk about Lake Wobegon. I talk about being 74. I talk about how much better life is now than it was back in my day.
How so? How is it better?
Oh, we have all of these wonderful, wonderful inventions. The iPhone and email and GPS and tracking numbers and everything that I can think of. I like all of it. And with the exception of the iPod, people who walk around with wires going into their ears, they just really seriously are missing out on real life.
That's Garrison Keillor appearing Sunday at the Florida Theater. Get your tickets at floridatheater.com. Well, tomorrow marks International Human Rights Day. And to mark the occasion, a pop-up public art event is set for Jacksonville. It will celebrate the anniversary of the passing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the end of World War II under the leadership of Eleanor Roosevelt. Hope McMath, former director of the Kummer Museum, is here with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning.
You created this event.
I and a few good creative friends came up with this initiative.
And so first of all, let's explain the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a milestone document in the history of human rights. It was drafted by representatives from all over the world and proclaimed at the UN General Assembly in Paris on December 10th, 1948.
That's right. So ever since, December 10th has been deemed International Human Rights Day. The document is fantastic. For any of your listeners who are unaware of it, it's elegant in how simple it is. And it is a document that many nations have used as the basis for their own human rights laws and treaties amongst nations. And it's a document that really speaks to the basic human rights, dignities, and freedoms that every human being upon the earth should have. Mm-hmm. So it's built around 30 articles, and I've used it as a basis for my work as an artist for many years. And I think for a lot of people across the globe, they're often looking for those ways to describe what are our basic human rights. It's one of those documents that's a real go-to.
What Americans think of as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I guess, in a nutshell. But going even beyond that.
Going beyond that, it really speaks to political rights, social rights, cultural access, economic rights, rights in the workplace. So it's fairly broad and all-encompassing, and yet open enough to be flexible as times move forward.
So you'll be marking the day with art. What's on the agenda?
So we have a group of visual artists and performing artists that are going to go throughout the urban core, and we are going to be putting up wheat paste installations, which are large installations of images and words that speak to universal human rights. We're going to be in the Springfield area, downtown, and Five Points. We will have actors under the leadership of Barbara Colicello leading readings of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And there will be participatory opportunities at each stop. So the idea is to make very visible this idea of the full embrace of human rights, especially in this time post-election.
And you see this as relevant, not just to mark the December 10th date, but just generally, given the climate we're in today. Why is that?
Well, I think what we're seeing, not just since the election, but even in the months leading up to it, real division in our country. We obviously are seeing new instances of hate speech and hateful acts and declarations against people. And what we're trying to do through this work is to proclaim loudly and boldly that we want to be a community that accepts all people and provides equal protection for all people. Now, whether that's how our laws and policies actually play out right now, there is a room for all of us to practice that work as we move through the world. And so we believe art can often be the leader in setting that kind of expectation. You know, we've seen in community leaders throughout the country, mayors and city council people making very strong statements of acceptance, love, tolerance, and equity. We have not seen that happen yet in Jacksonville, so we feel like we will let the artists lead the way.
I see. And how can people
people find out where this artwork is going up? This is public art.
It's public art. So from 9 o'clock tomorrow morning until about noon, we will be moving around downtown Springfield and Five Points. We're going to be starting out at Five Points at what's going to be the new Bread and Board restaurant, the old Richard's Deli. So we'll begin there and then moving throughout. So we don't have a hard and specific schedule because we're going to be moving as the work is completed and depending on what the public interaction looks like. But people will be able to stumble upon us all day tomorrow morning and then hopefully stumble upon the images and words and in the coming days and weeks.
And there's a hashtag people can follow on social media to track this, With Love Jax.
So With Love Jax is this great grassroots effort here in Jacksonville led by Alicia Bowman that was created as a counter to the KKK flyers that came out last year. So they are one of the partners in this work. White and Woke is also going to be involved in this work. So we'll be posting images and schedules at hashtag White and Woke. So there's lots of ways that people can follow us, but it's pretty organic, very grassroots. And so if you come across us, we know you'll get a lot out of it, but you can also follow it throughout the morning on social media.
Look out for it tomorrow, as it is the anniversary of the founding of International Human Rights Day. Hope McMath, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or the WJCT app. And Diane Reams up next with a look at the week's top national news stories. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Enjoy your weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.